Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And we're very excited about our guest. Do you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm Dave from Dirty Projectors.
Dave, thanks for being here. It's very exciting.
Thanks for having me.
So what we're going to do today is we're going to break down your track, I Feel Energy, off of your new album, Lamplit Prose. It is, in short, extremely energetic.
Yes.
It's extremely fun. And what I want to do is I want to look at, what are the ingredients that make someone feel energy through music? Because you do it really well on this song. Thanks. The second half we're going to look at is this Dirty Projector song, which might be known for being angular or indie or out there. Actually, a pop song in disguise. Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, wow. That was no suspense.
That's cool.
There.
I didn't know which it was going to be.
So, to kick things off, we should listen to the song because we want to get it in our ears.
Are we fundamentally alone in the universe? What would it possibly mean if we found in each other something unexplained? I feel we lingering, strange night in the summer night sky. Something of that man, the shadows beginning from the time when my eyes are the desire. I feel energy. Could this be just a tender dream? I feel energy, yeah. I breathe, you breathe, breathe. I feel energy.
Beautiful.
Yeah. This is like a, what I think of as an alarm clock song. Like, you know, if you have a clock radio and you can program it to play a certain song when you wake up, this is like something that will get you out of bed. All through high school, I listened to James Brown's Get Up Off of That Thing in the morning. But this would be like a good substitute, I think.
That's awesome.
Dave, I want to get into what the ingredients are of the ecstatic energy that is being created here. But before we do, would you share a bit about where this song came from?
It's one of those songs that's just sort of coalesced. Less of a decisive moment of like, oh, great, here's the verse. It was more like a collection of things that came together.
So it was sort of collaged from different snippets of melody and harmony?
Yeah, totally.
Interesting.
Totally, yeah. The bridge is probably the first part and just that kind of like crazy chord progression, which I didn't really like realize at first was a bridge. I was like, oh, in that it sort of feels sort of like wandering and vaguely modulatory, this would be a good bridge. And then how long-winded the bridge was made me want to do something super static in the rest of the song. I think oftentimes, like left to my own devices, I don't know why this is, but I won't do the thing of just like four chords and like finding different ways of approaching that. You know, I like to write these melodies that are harmonized differently over the course of a whatever 16 bar phrase or whatever. So the it felt like a cool challenge here to be like, all right, like what if it's just four chords? And I guess it's actually six chords, but basically, you know.
Sure. So for me, the first ingredient that really stuck out was the rhythm, because you open the song with this utterly confusing and exciting and overjoyed drum.
That. Okay.
That was eerily accurate. Yeah.
What I wanted to do, this thing totally beguiled me. I couldn't figure out what you were doing when I listened to this. When I heard the hook, I was like, hook works, I'm having fun, I'm listening, I'm dancing, I got energy. But then when I like really zoomed in and listened closely to what was going on, I got more confused, which is kind of an amazing...
That's cool.
Like, it's an amazing thing. Like, on first listen, it's great. On second listen, what? And so I spent a bunch of time trying to figure out what is it that makes this hook of the 808 bass line so compelling. What I wanted to do was listen to this rhythm, and I want to sort of deconstruct it into its individual parts and see how that, what was going on through your wild mind to put this thing together. So let's listen to the sequence from the opening of the track. I do love that.
That one, like, drums were my first instrument. And just practicing things like doing the classic, practicing that like over and over again.
Oh, like a paradiddle almost.
Like just like the fill, you know, the two rack toms and the four
around the horn.
Yeah, around the horn, exactly. And so I meant that to be kind of like a. Just like a joke on that whole idea, like just as a funny way to start this. But then, yeah, mixing like a triplet thing into it.
So. Yeah, and you've got people talking in the background. It kind of has this live feel. It's fun right there. But I want to zoom in on the part immediately after the fill. So let's listen to this one more time.
Yep.
Ooh. So the first thing I caught was that, well, I had to take this and I had to reduce it down to, let's just get the bass. And so you're using an 808 here of some kind, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took the 808, we isolated it. And the first thing that I picked up on here was that there seemed to be, I heard, an initial motif that gets reused. I think there's times when you sort of reduce this riff down to just sort of elemental parts of it and other parts where you extend it and make it bigger and it goes on and on and on in unpredictable ways.
Yeah.
But the thing that sort of felt like the nugget, the motif, was just the introduction part.
Yeah.
Just that, right? Like,
and
so I think like a lot of pop producers could take that and go, ba-da-dum-bum-bum, and just keep doing it, and you got a good loop, and that would have been a fun song.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like this was not sufficient for you.
Maybe not, yeah. Well, okay, actually, the first layer of the rhythm that I made was the bottles. And there's a little bit of a backstory there, which is that when I was mixing the self-titled record from 2017 with Jimmy Douglas, there was a song on that record. Wait, how am I blanking what song? Oh, it's Up in Hudson from the self-titled record.
Yeah.
And we were mixing it. And like, I felt so bad for him bringing that album to him because it was this thing of like, I've been working on this for months. It's 115 tracks. Mix it, you know? And so he spent a lot of time just sort of going through, figuring out what various subgroups were and tracks were. And I remember as we were doing that with Up in Hudson, he soloed out this bottle pattern that was actually played by Mauro Rafosco, who's like an amazing my favorite
4-0 in the dark.
Oh wow, you're ahead.
I've played with Mauro. We can get into that later, but he's amazing.
Mauro is incredible. But anyway, so Jimmy soloed this out and he was just listening to this and in the most amazing way, Jimmy, I think, was sort of skeptical of some of the more like deconstructing impulses that that I had on that album. And so, I don't know, something he said about the bottles just stuck in my mind where he was like, that feels so good. He was just like, somebody's going to sample that and make a song out of that.
So you sampled yourself.
So I was like, a couple months later, I was like sitting in the studio. I was like, I'm going to take the bottles. And so I had that and... And yeah, so I was just playing around with like 808s. Maybe I was actually trying to reclaim the deconstruction because I liked that just 4-5-1 And then I was like, you know, I just wanted to keep on going, make something, I don't know, that felt like that you could ride in, but you were also just like, wait, what exactly? You know, like, where it came back around at a point where you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it allowed you to move in a different way than just something a little more like normative maybe would.
Right.
As we're talking about it, I was not thinking about this. And in you know how it is in general, you're not like thinking about like these things, but
we had a listener who wanted to specifically ask you, how much are you thinking about like theory and composition versus intuition?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what key a lot of my songs are in, which is funny when we're rehearsing it. Kristen will be like, is this in B flat? No. I thought it was in G. And but I think I had read the Philip Glass memoir, Words Without Music.
Sure, yeah.
And he was talking about like mixing his like, you know, like Nadia Boulanger training with the transcription that he was doing for Ravi Shankar. Mm. And he was talking about these different approaches to rhythm and the Indian music approach of like additive rhythm, where you're taking these like sort of rhythmic cells and just, you know, stringing them together. That's kind of what happened here.
Ah, okay. So, you know? And so you basically, you had this funky little bottle rhythm. You needed some 808s and you're putting a sort of inspired Indian rhythm over these with the 808s.
Again, wasn't thinking of it that way, but yeah, maybe I just felt like where the one is and where, you know, the rhythmic integrity of the bottles is so abundant that to destabilize it a little bit with the 808 felt like
Cuz it's coming in on all sorts of strange places. So I wanted to, just for listeners to help them understand what's going on here, I wanted to walk through sort of each piece of this rhythm. It took me doing so to like finally get my head around it.
Okay.
And in some ways, like, the song is great because I couldn't get my head around it, right? It's almost like it just demands you to dance around it and sort of find your place and then come back. And I like that it does that, but I'm infinitely analytical and I had to understand what was going on.
Break it down, Chuck.
So just going back to to the riff one more time. So it's in our ear. Beautiful. And this is not the only it's not a loop that goes through the song. It goes through all sorts of permutations. It changes, but I found this rhythm to be the motif. So you give us that the first time.
Yep.
The next time, you kind of extrapolate on it. You go high this time. You give us an extra little zhuzh right there.
A little zhuzh.
And then you take this and you use a tool called rhythmic displacement, where you take the same idea, but you place it on different rhythms within the bar. Mm. So the ba-da-dum, that thing, we're going to hear multiple times coming in different places. Surprising. And just to throw us off a little bit, at the very end, you kind of go back to the main motif, but it jumps in a place you don't expect. Right, so if we listen to the original, the motif, and we listen to the ending, you surprise us. Things jump in just a little quicker. And, oh, God, it throws you off your feet. And then, so we can put those all back together, and we can hear them in context again. I can't sing it back for you because I don't have that rhythm. But one of the things that amazes me is you then take this and it just goes through so many different permutations, so that my ear is always surprised. And this is why I think the rhythm is just an essential part of the ingredients for energy. Is I think ecstaticism comes from this overjoyed sense, but with unpredictability. And there's so much unpredictability in how you manage this riff. And so later on, I think when we get perhaps later into the verse, you bring it back, but not only do you have this rhythmic displacement where you take that motif and you sort of move it around the bar, you actually start to introduce some new notes using basically melodic sequences, where it's a similar sort of thing, but you're changing it. So here's what we hear later on in the verse. It's Madman.
So it's always familiar, but never quite the same. Is that the idea?
That's what I'm catching.
Cool.
What's going on in your mind? It seems like this is a big part of the intent as you're going into the song.
Yeah.
Or the intuition.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a flow, you know? I mean, you have the approximate feeling of it, even if you can't quite sing it.
Because underneath there is kind of that core, ba-da-dum-bum-bum. Like, it's in there, but it's always moving around, and it's never just exactly where you think it's going to be until you come back around, and then, you know, at the end of that section, maybe in the next section you get, you're back on the beat, or you expect it to be.
Yeah. Just the specific feel of where those land in a kind of, like, grid of four, if you're internalizing that. I just, like, there's momentum there. There's to me, it was just, it's less about, I mean, you know, I love to break things down and think about how they work, why they work, and all that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, for me, it was just sort of like, this moves, you know?
And what people don't get to see is your extraordinary dancing.
For those listening at home, it's like kind of like funky head bobbing, but with sort of a quizzical expression. It's like, this is making me move, but I don't know why.
So I had some other ingredients that for me was really bringing out the energy of the track. And an obvious place where a lot of people start is in lyric. And I think there's an almost seemingly contradictory thing happening with the lyric, which is that in the verses, it's pretty down, right? So, and of course, the chorus is extremely up.
Yeah.
And for me, the clash of these two, not only is it sort of, for me, the central message that I get from the song, but the contrast is what makes the highs feel so much higher. So what I want to do is just play for folks the second verse, where it's pretty clear we're in a low spot. Sometimes I get so depressed and I just can't move. Don't cry, they make you feel like you're dead, and it's never gonna improve. But then something unexpected. I wish when I was blue that I could sing with that much joy. There's this really fun, like, there's this clashing of how you're singing and what you're saying. Hmm. And when we finally get to the chorus, well, it's just overjoyed, right? I feel energy. Could this be just a tender dream? I feel energy. Yeah. I'm curious. I'm actually mostly curious. What is on your grin right now?
No, just something silly, because I went, then you, and then your voice went like, yeah. And I was thinking about just like, the way pitch can get locked into a grid. You almost did just a spoken.
It's the musicality of our own voices. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, it makes the energy that much sweeter, right? That's like the payoff that you get. Without feeling the lows, the highs don't hit as hard or something.
Yeah, maybe there's an element of like kind of mania to the song in that way. You don't have the highs without the lows.
Mm. The contrast is, I think, further enhanced in the harmony. And when we listen to the horn line, this is the other piece for me, which is just an absolute essential ingredient for energy. And of course, horns are going to bring energy. Mm-hmm. But you bring in horns in a way which are kind of jarring. So just as we have in the lyrics, we have this sort of tension between dark and light. We have that happening in the horns as well, because they come in.
But let's just talk a little bit more about the highs and the lows.
Yeah. Talk about
if you want to. To me, there was something that felt, you know, not overtly, but maybe a little bit topical in finally writing the lyrics to the song, which were kind of the last element, which is just sort of like against the backdrop of, you know, the encroaching fascism and everything, and just like so much bad news and, you know, disheartening stuff out there, and just sort of like the and maybe we'll wind up there. I think you have a program for how where we're gonna go.
We can go anywhere,
but just this idea of like, how do you respond to that? Do you let it just take you out and you just curl up in a fetal position on the floor?
I've done a lot of that.
Or can it be some sort of imperative to action, to movement? Is there a way to come together and to respond collectively and articulating like joyfully, like what we stand for, what we believe in, you know? So
I really believe deeply in a politics of joy, which is that if you're not fighting for the joy that you want to exist in the world, and you're only coming from anger, then kind of what you're fighting for is anger.
Yeah.
And anger has an important role in exciting people and getting out in the streets and moving people. But if underlying it isn't joy, you're missing something essential. And it really speaks to me, because Nate and I actually, I think out of that, I had been curled up on the sofa plenty over the last couple of years.
As we all have,
the rise of authoritarianism. And Nate and I felt it was really important to go get out the vote. So we were actually driving around in Southern California listening to this track as we were knocking on people's doors and encouraging them to.
Canvassing soundtrack.
Yeah. And it worked.
Wow.
So if it feels its message.
That's awesome. Wow. That's so cool.
Right. But maybe, again, because it acknowledges that pain and depression and darkness, too. Like, it would be perhaps artificial to just have the highs, you know?
Mm.
Yeah. I remember I was, like, playing a rough version of the song for Laura Lee Rodriguez, Empress Of, when it was maybe like half done or so. And some of the words were different. It was just sort of a scratch vocal. But the second verse line about like sometimes I get so depressed was in there. And she was like, that right there, that's a really important to the song. And her saying that, I was kind of, oh yeah, you're right. That's a great, that's a great call. And that was a little bit of a key to unlocking, like what the story was in the words.
Part of the songwriter is to pen things that would maybe feel uncomfortable to say aloud, but when we sing them, all of a sudden we have permission to get into the depths of what we're really feeling.
Oh yeah, yeah, I'm a believer in that.
I appreciate you putting that in there. Let's talk about harmony.
Let's talk about these horns already.
Let's talk about some horns.
Sounds good.
I just love the horns, but the thing that stuck out to me about these horns is that you bring these horns in literally in a minor way. You have this little minor ascending sequence that they play. And then they end on the major. It's sort of embodied within just this tiny little moment when the horns enter into the chorus. We have the same movement of depressed into energy in condensed down into a musical line. And I think that's wonderful.
Wow.
You mean just that, like, da 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 da?
That, exactly that. Yeah.
Because it starts.
What scale are you in? Is that a flat two?
It's like flat six, five.
Okay.
One flat seven.
One flat seven, and then natural six, five, at least on the top harmony in the trumpet. Right. So it starts. So it's literally starting on the flat six, which is borrowed from the minor scale, and then by the, you know, the crest of that line, it's like,
I love that.
Reached up to the major six.
This is really helpful for me. I struggled with that because I was like, wait, why is that one like that, but the other one's like that? And I was sort of like, is it? Sometimes you get, you like, you know, you're just making an idea and you're like, oh, there's supposed to be an apostrophe there or whatever. And that was one where I was sort of like, should it be that dissonant?
Yes.
And at the end of the day, I was like, it ha- I don't know why, but it has to be. Yeah. And the way you're telling a story of that, that's awesome, man. That's
thank you.
Wow.
Yeah. Minor to major, dissonance to consonants. That's why that moment is, or part of the reason it's so cathartic. And then the bottles come in, and then it's like,
and we're back up. We got energy.
It's energy.
That's cool. Great. That's cool.
So we've got ingredients of energy coming from rhythm, from lyric, from harmony. Are there any other elements for you that stood out that are bringing the energy here?
I mean, just Amber Mark's voice.
Yes.
It's insane. And it's so, it has so much energy and power in it.
Yeah. We're going to save that for the second half because it's so fantastic and we're going to dig into it. So maybe what we'll do is we'll take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to ask the question of whether or not this is a pop song in disguise. And we're going to figure out why it is. So Nate, when we were recording, we were interrupted by a delivery truck.
Yes.
Check out what I got.
Let's see. The unveiling. It is... Oh, it's a quip.
It's a quip.
Oh, that's a sexy packaging, too.
Yeah, it's really nice. So I've actually been loving the Quip electric toothbrush so much that there has been actually some envy in my family.
Quip envy. Okay, tell me more.
Well, so I've been using my Quip, and I really like it because it has this like cool little suction thing that it suctions to your mirror.
Yeah.
And they're actually like really good looking, and they work really well. And so my wife was like, I want a Quip. And I was like, all right, I'm going to get you a Quip. So I think we got a new Quip in here.
And the moment of truth, there it is. Yeah, that's a good looking device. Not only is it an incredible decoration to add to your bathroom, it actually, Charlie, is a very functional electric toothbrush as well, created by dentists and designers, designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable.
Quip is backed by over 20,000 dental professionals, and Quip starts at just $25 if you go to getquip.com/onpop right now. You get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush.
That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/onpop.
Man, there should be a beat to that. So for a lot of listeners to switch on pop who may have more of their listening on the top 40 charts, Dirty Projectors may be dissonant and angular and a little
difficult, unpleasant, off-putting, alienating, abstruse, recondite. We can pick more up later. Yeah.
All the things that I love about the Dirty Projectors.
All right.
But one of the things I noticed when I was listening to this track is that it actually felt like there was a lot of corollary things happening in top 40 pop music that for folks who may not know your music or for whom they are sort of more accustomed to just like straightforward pop music, I thought it would be a great sort of like gateway drug into this track. And so we're going to do a segment we're going to call Across the Charts. And we're going to listen to a couple of the things that I'm hearing that have a lot of resonance just with in terms of message, sound, other things. By no means are we saying they are copying, borrowing, or even related, but it's just things that I'm hearing and they're exciting. So what I want to do is I'll play you some tracks that we're hearing in the top 40, things that are some of the top 10, and I want to see if there are points of resonance. And if there aren't, you're like, you're totally wrong, that's fun too. So the first track I want to play for you is called Happier by Marshmello and Bastille.
Then only for a minute, I want to change my mind, 'cause this just don't feel right to me. I wanna raise your spirits, I want to see you smile. I like that.
Gentlemen, what are you hearing? Any Dirty Projectors relationships? What do you think?
The first time, I've heard this song before. I heard it in an Uber a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And to me, the close relationship, we didn't hear the verse in when we listened just now, but the close relationship of the movement of the verse melody and the words, it felt like very like... it felt like good storytelling.
Yeah.
And I like responded to it. You know, the production is maybe not what I would like to always live in or something, but I was like, as a like when you're writing a melody and then you're writing words and everything, that oftentimes it's hard to find the lyric that exactly matches the grammar of the melody or whatever. Mm. And with this specific song, I was like, damn, like They're really entwined.
Yeah. Part of what Bastille does well in the vocal is a shifting from a straight feel to a triplet feel, and it happens so seamlessly. But it also introduces, I think, a little bit of unease in the lyric, because so the thing that I'm hearing is that I think there's some lyrical connections that basically here we have a song that. Is called Happier, but it's about a breakup.
Yeah.
And you know, you're not writing a breakup song, but I like this idea that we can take the lows in our life and find a way out of them. And so Bastille singing about, you know, I want you to be happier, so I got to break up with you. And just as they're sort of moving from the pre-chorus into the drop, we get this, you know, with this big sort of Euro hook that down, you know, that kind of thing. And what a great way to overcome pain. So there's just some lyrical connection. Okay, well, I want to move on to the next track.
Wait, do you say something about triplets in there?
Yeah, in the verse, we didn't hear it. He's like on that Migos flow, the Versace.
Oh, interesting.
When the morning comes and we see what we've become, in the cold light of day, we're a flame in the wind, not the fire that we begun.
Which is interesting, in the context of Marshmello, but then also in the context of Bastille.
Yeah. I just want to take that. I have to say that I used to use your music in my music theory classes, Dave, to illustrate simple meter versus compound meter.
Oh, really?
I used Temecula Sunrise because it goes from like a division of the beat in groups of three, you know, da 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 da. It's like 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2, then it switches like 1 and 2. And 1 and 2. So the so the beat stays the same, but the division changes, right? 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 and 2 and 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 and 2. And so the first is compound and the second is simple. And when you're working with, you know, freshman music students, it's like a really great way to get into that idea. Sorry, that was not related to anything. I just thought of it.
But it is happening in the Bastille track.
There's so much productive tension
between
a triple feel and a double feel. And I was like coming back on a plane from, we did a live from here.
That's such a fun show. It was Bastille,
It was so fun. And then like everybody was flying back to LA. And I was in a conversation with a couple of the guys in the Live From Here band.
So talented.
Yeah, they're insane. It's like, I mean, they're like, that was really, really fun. It was really inspiring to be a part of. But they, you know, we were kind of talking and people were like, oh yeah, like I think trap is done. You know, I think that it's going to be opening up into some more like creative things. And I had to be like, what are you guys talking about? Like, like the way that trap like gives emotional and formal meaning to these new subdivisions of the 16th note and like this new variation between like triplets and eighths and 16ths, like that's forever. That's like a new vocabulary.
Yeah.
And like maybe the production will change, but those are like amazing tools. It's here to stay.
Yeah. So maybe that's a great segue into the next track, because I'm hearing some of those, the way in which you're playing with rhythm and some of the sounds that you're using, I'm hearing elsewhere with things that might be more directly derivative or drawing from a trap aesthetic. So this is LMI's Trip. But I think that I'm done tripping, I'm tripping, I've been sipping, that's how I control this feeling you keep giving, you keep on hitting it, ooh, oh. Maybe it's your love, it's too good to be true. Baby boy, your love got me tripping on you. You know your love is big enough, made me trip up on you. Yeah, it's big enough, got me tripping on you. Tripping, tripping on you. My bad for tripping on you. So Dave, I want to ask you, just for especially for folks who might be not as familiar with sort of the subdivisions of sounds and rhythms that you were mentioning, could you just describe what you're hearing in that song, which are pulling from a trap aesthetic and the sort of new vocabulary that's available to us?
I mean, maybe just in the hat, you know, in the hats.
Yeah, the hi-hats. Yeah.
Definitely.
The way that they're moving, you know, that the whole kind of elastic quality of, you know, switching between something that's like straight.
Yeah, would you be so bold as to try a beatbox of like a straight trap?
Definitely not. Definitely not.
Then we've got Nate Sloan, professor. What's a, oh, can man, you give me a straight hi-hat?
This is borderline abusive. You want me to do a
straight hi-hat? Like, straight hi-hat, yeah.
So straight hi-hat.
Yeah.
So like just like,
yeah. Yeah.
How do you do a hi-hat sound? Tick, 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 tick.
Great. There you go. So there you go. You got.
Are you satisfied?
I'm satisfied. Now, what would a trap artist do with a hi-hat? So much. Okay. What do you think, Dave?
Or we could just listen to the song. You know?
Yeah, that was terrible.
So, okay. I'm sorry. What stood out for me in this track was her vocal. And I'm hearing, I really like the way in which there is this movement between staccato and legato singing and where she's sort of jumping in on rhythms where you're just not exactly sure where she's going to end up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You hearing that?
I feel it. Yeah. I mean, I know Boot Up and I know this one. Those are the only two LMI songs, but they're both so solid. I want to go deeper on her album. Mm. I think the first thing that sticks out to me is actually the traditional character of it, how it feels like, the melodies and the way it's harmonized feels like SWV or like Groove Theory or something.
Yeah.
Her voice has that 90s R&B quality. Mm. And then those kind of like block harmonies, that the three-part block harmonies that she throws the hooks on in both Boot Up and this one are so cool. They just sound so good.
Mm. I think in Boot Up, we even get more of her fantastic rhythmic flexibility. Boot Up has this almost sort of onomatopoeia sort of feel to it, right? It's both like boot up and
oh right,
it's the sound of getting together and it kind of like flows together. It's very scat-ish and she uses it over and over, like is it scatting or is she saying we are booed up? You never quite find which one it is, and that being in between matches the sort of insecurity of the trap hi-hat. It's like it could kind of end up anywhere. You never quite know, and it's exciting. Nate, do you have anything you would like to share about LMI?
I guess I'm just thinking, you know, about productive tension and this, how the trap drums are doing this like complex rhythmic thing, but then on top of that, like Dave was saying, her voice is so conversational and yeah, just feels like eminently natural. So maybe that's like the productive tension of that song, you know, that the drums are very jittery and unsettled, but her vocals are just like kind of serene and that goes together really well.
Yeah. It's like a timeless song, timeless melody. And then certainly the rhythmic pattern underneath it feels like
very much of really today. Yeah. Yeah.
Instant earworm.
Yeah.
It's like,
can we hear it again?
Yeah. But I think that I'm done tripping. I'm tripping. I've been sipping. It's to more legato.
Baby boy, your love got me tripping on you. You know your love is big enough, made me trip up on you. Yeah, it's big enough, got me tripping on you. Tripping on you. My bad.
Love to hear a Dirty Projectors cover of that.
Man. Yeah. And
I feel like your vocalist could hit those.
Oh, yeah. No, they definitely could. And just by the filtering that they're doing to the hats or whatever, it almost has like a melodic quality. Like the melodic quality of the hats is really cool.
That's a good one.
One thing I caught just listening to that next time around was, you know, oftentimes when we track vocals, you might just do a line at a time, right? Mm-hmm. And then you bring them all together. Mm-hmm. But there's this one moment where she's like, I'm tripping on you, and she actually trips over her vocal. Like, I think they intentionally sort of put, or you can hear her singing over herself as the next line comes in. Whether intentionally or not, it's a great effect.
I like that.
Yeah. This is where I go, like, conspiracy theory.
Let's do another one.
Let's do another one. Moving on.
That's
all right.
That's a deep read.
Last one for Across the Charts. I want to play Khalid's Better. Nothing feels better than this. Unfortunately, have to fade out over my favorite part, which is the talk box.
There's
a nice talk box solo at the end.
Whoa,
which is fun. Yeah.
Whoa.
What are you all hearing in this?
Oh, it's making me feel very optimistic about the state of pop music right now. If you said these are all currently on the top 100,
yeah,
that's rad.
Yeah,
I mean these are great tracks.
Yeah,
and they've got. I mean, this to me is like so similar in a way to the LMI. It's got that trap hi hat sound underneath. Again, like a very languorous, like beautiful vocal with maybe also some sort of 90s throwback elements as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm curious, but you also have a Dirty Projectors axis here?
For me, the axis is primarily... Well, one, we have a sort of a lyrical connection of a positive, enthusiastic message that's maybe a little derivative. There's not much that's maybe not the deepest connection. But for me, I'm hearing the 808 as a great entry into I Feel Energy. And one of the things I love about how the kick drum / 808, and here there's actually I think two different things happening. There's both a kick and an 808 bass sub that come in together, and I think that here you're getting that same sort of quality of, it's not your typical, it's not a rock backbeat kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm, you never quite know exactly when the kick is going to hit. Mm. And that surprise is what keeps you consistently interested, even if underneath it we're getting a, as you described, sort of this languid sort of loop, this very sort of washy feel. The thing that gives me energy in that is, where is the kick going to hit? And I think if people are enjoying that trap kick sound, I think that they're going to be super into I Feel Energy, because I think you take that and you extend it to its logical ends, to the place where I'm always trying to guess where it's going to come in, and I'm always trying to dance around it. So that's my Khalid Better connection.
I can see it. I can see it.
Downbeat agnosticism or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I like that. Downbeat agnosticism.
I'm buying.
I feel like they're in that one, you know, to get into this the way you're like getting conspiracy theory on the
please come on
on the LMI, closer. And you're like, oh man, like as she's tripping, her vocal is tripping. I love that. But to me, like, to ask the what the relationship is between the words and the character of the melody here, it feels like there's one of irony or dissonance between like nothing gets better than this. Mm. And then the sort of like equivocal character, the conflicted emotional character.
Yeah.
That to me, I don't know, maybe I have to listen to the whole song a little bit more or something, but I'm sort of like, well, it doesn't get better than this.
I think there was I think on first read, the song kind of looks like a relationship. And then on the second read, it's kind of like a casual hookup is what the song is about. And so perhaps there is that underlying feeling of like, oh, maybe this thing isn't as satisfying as it seems to be as it's presented. I don't know. That's a really, I really appreciate your sort of fine tuning, looking at how are they saying the thing that they're saying?
Yeah.
it's kind of like me being like, hey Nate, how you doing today? And you're like,
good.
Yeah, it has that feel.
Or you just saying how you like, if Nate just did like was curt to you or something, and you were like, how you doing today, man?
Our entire relationship.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's like, it doesn't get any better than this. Yeah. Or is he being like, it doesn't get better than this?
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That was the read.
Hands up, eyes down.
That was Oscar worthy. That was great.
Okay, so we've made some connections between some things that are happening in the charts. Some of it's on, some of it's off. That's fine. I'm curious, you know, you have a really strong, pronounced sound that when I hear a song by Dave, I know I'm listening to a song by Dave. And that's something that every artist, I think, strives for. Within a few seconds, I'm like, oh, it's a Dairy Projector song. I got it. But you've also, in the last couple of years, been collaborating with some major pop acts. You've collaborated with Solange. You collaborated on the song 4 or 5 Seconds, which was probably the biggest supergroup ever created of all time, with Paul McCartney and Kanye and Rihanna. And on your last album, you brought in a lot of electronic sort of beat-making sounds into your indie rock aesthetic, and sort of found a meeting point between the two of them. And so when I was listening to this track, I had this just realization, like, this thing's a pop song. It's a pop song. And there, I wanted to look at a couple of things that for me, like, it stood out that this is a pop song in some kind of sheep's clothing. And the first thing I noticed, like, as I was listening to this song, I was like, I'm trying to figure out, because of all of these moving rhythms and trying to find, literally sometimes find my downbeat, I was like, how is this song constructed? And then I was like, oh, it's a pop song structure. It is literally verse, pre-chorus, chorus. And what's amazing about pop is that one thing that is sort of indelible across contemporary pop music is that form tends to be somewhat more solid than the maybe instrumental choices that we can make. Mm-hmm. So I just want to play for folks how this really wild and exciting song does map out in a way that we have just enough predictability within its form to have something to work with.
So let's establish the platonic pop form first, yeah. Right? So verse, pre-chorus, chorus, verse.
Usually a shorter second verse.
Sure. Otherwise. Yeah, maybe a double verse the first time.
Curt verse. The
but second no. Yeah. Try. You're already messing it up. Okay. We're just doing the simplest version. Yeah. Verse, pre-chorus, chorus. Verse, pre-chorus, chorus. Bridge. Chorus. Outro.
Yes, exactly. Great. So we've got,
and maybe there's a refrain after the second chorus before the bridge that also happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
After the
thank third, you, Dave. Increasingly, chorus. A refrain or post-chorus. Good.
Yeah. Okay. So here's I Feel Energy in its reduced form. We get a verse. We build the energy into a pre-chorus.
Wow.
And of course, we get a chorus. And I love that you deliver us a down bridge.
Yeah.
And a string outro. Now, that's not usual, but I love it. I had to play it. It maps onto a normal pop form. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that something that you're deliberately thinking about as you're constructing your song?
I like form. Yeah. I like form because also it's like every song is a movie, you know? Mm. And I like when things start somewhere and end somewhere different.
Mm.
And so I love the way form is a way of like thinking about those things.
Oh, I see. Like the way movies have like a conventional 3-act structure, but there's like infinite variations.
Yeah. On
that arc. Maybe music is analogous. Okay, cool.
You start and end in very different places in this song, which I'm now realizing.
Do I?
Yeah. You start with your.
Oh, right.
And then you have this beautiful string quartet thing at the end.
Right.
Very sentimental.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true. But the chords for the outro are the same chords as the bridge.
Oh, yeah.
So right. Maybe there's something there.
Didn't catch that, did you, Charlie?
What do you think the form that you're bringing here, how is it serving the listener?
I don't know. Maybe like what we were talking about earlier in terms of like responding to the stuff that gets us down.
Yeah.
And, you know, navigating a response to it. What is the response? The response is action.
Yeah.
You're down. What's the way of navigating that? What's the passage toward claiming joy or whatever? Mm.
I think you do a really great job of walking me through that experience. And the formalism of the form gives me something to hold on to that then allows for all the experimentation of rhythm, such that you've got me, I'm with you. And if you had extended that 808 it through infinite permutations for 18 minutes, unless you're Steve Reich, you're going to lose me.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you're moving into a different, you'd be moving into minimalist, other kinds of music. But you're, right, you're holding me, and there is the safety of the form opens up so much experimentation, I find.
I love that way of putting it. Yeah, it's like, you know, like a ghost story is going to have a structure.
Right.
The form allows you to do anything. Mm. And particularly when I'm getting all weird with the modal mixture and the additive rhythm and the rest of it, yeah, the structure that we intuitively understand what's going to be happening next allows Dirty Projectors to like take these other weird risks, you know?
Yeah.
No, that makes, I mean, it's to avoid the conventional pop song form, perhaps allows you to avoid what Stravinsky called the abyss of freedom.
Yeah. Oh.
Infinite choice is not so.
Okay, so I just have a quick thought, because I'm thinking, I love hearing the you know, sort of emotional political backdrop of this composition, you know, and hearing it as like a call to collective joy and collective action. And is that perhaps mirrored in the numerous, you know, collaborations that mark this album as well? We've got Amber Mark on this track. We've got Empress Of appearing on the album, Dear Nora, Haim. So probably some other people I'm not thinking of right now.
Rostam and Robin.
Yeah. Was that a conscious or maybe a subconscious reaction to that fetal position you were talking about to like reach out to other people?
I think so. You know, yeah. And also just sort of a response to the previous record, which was so kind of solitary.
Yeah.
I think I did get these songs to a certain point, and I was like, it wants to feel more collective than this, you know. It feels like, you know, I want to be singing with people.
Cool.
Well, that was the other thing that stood out for me, that which like really brings this into a pop aesthetic, is that you brought along Amber Mark, who is an extraordinary rising pop star who we've had on our show as one of our absolute favorite guests.
Oh, she's been on your show. Yeah. I gotta check that episode.
Really fun.
We did some Kendrick Lamar breakdowns together.
Yeah,
we
like to humble together.
Yeah, we kind of made her basically.
Yeah, no. But I just want to listen to Amber's vocal because it's really stunning.
Yeah.
I feel energy.
Ooh, that drum outro. But tell us about what is Amber's vocal doing here for you? How is it serving the song?
There's so much power in her voice, you know, and her timbre, and you know, what you can sing something and then another person can sing it, it means totally different things. I love what she does on this song.
I was actually surprised by how well your voices blend, because you both have very distinct voices, and yet they came together in a really gorgeous way.
That's cool, yeah.
I'm curious if there are, either consciously or subconsciously through just absorption, other elements of pop songwriting or an aesthetic that you bring into the Dirty Projectors.
I mean, I would imagine so. It would be maybe better to talk about it like in a specific sort of instance. Yeah. But
I feel energy. Anything else I'm missing?
Oh, other elements in this song? This might be more the dreaded word indie than pop, in that there's like a historical investigation happening, or like a historical fantasy a little bit in the song.
What do you mean?
Ooh.
Just like the idea of like before, like when disco was still live instruments.
Mm.
And then at the same time on the other side of town, there was like no wave music happening. There, like that, I feel like is maybe the kind of like the primal scene of the production of this song, where there's something sort of spiky and like aggressive about like the, you know, the guitars and things, but then, you know, then there's like a live disco element to like the Rhodes and the drumming and stuff.
Yeah, I get some of the like the Niles Rogers and the guitar.
Also,
or Prince-ish even.
Also, you know, now once you dropped the disco bomb, I made this connection to Marvin Gaye's "Got to Give It Up," which, like, I feel energy starts with a lot of voices in a room, kind of, you know, it's you feel like you're in a party, and uses a Coke bottle percussion.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what kind of bottle you used on, or Mauro used on this track, but
they were Mountain Valley.
Good choice.
Does it have a better timbre?
For the connoisseur. Only Mountain Valley will do. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, so not only now, yeah, this is great. Not only mainstream pop, but, you know, pop of yours is filtering.
And I had this idea that, you know, how, like, it feels like a sort of, like, universal thing to make the album or the song that's like, this is the solo piano song.
Yeah, yeah.
This is just the guy and an acoustic guitar, actually.
Yeah.
You know? And I felt like maybe as universal, but at the other end of that was like, this is like the disco song.
Yeah.
This
like,
is...
It makes me think like, you know, the country star Kacey Musgraves
has a
disco song on her new album.
Right. Or like, this is The Weeknd, but it's like disco.
Yeah.
Right. Bringing in Daft Punk.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think, you know, you were kind of talking about it earlier, like playing with the... And this is probably all so in my head that it's you might not get it in the song per se, but like, you know, if the reputation of Dirty Projectors is like, you know, angular and what were some of the words you were using?
Abstruse, recondite, obscure.
Like, what if I just made like a disco song?
Yeah.
You know, so there was like an element of that, like, but could I do it in a totally just inspired weirdo way?
Well, I think part of what succeeds about this track for me is, as I said at the beginning, it's like, I heard it the first time. I was like, yep, I got energy. This is fun. I want to dance. And then it also, like, it's both lean in and lean back at the same time. Because I can lean back and listen to just have fun. And as soon as I lean in, I go conspiratorial. I'm like, what the heck is happening? What's going on in your brain to pull this thing apart? Mm. So it has layers that the more you listen to it, it continues to give. And I think that's something that... fans of pop music ought to spend some time with this song and listen in a little closer, zoom into parts, and you'll find that it keeps giving back. I think that's a really exciting part of the composition. I think we maybe
are you giving them homework?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Great. Quiz next week.
Yeah.
We'll be going over. Yeah.
What beat does the third chorus vocal enter on? All right. Homework. I think we've gone way too deep. I've had a lot of fun.
Not nearly enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is great.
Thank you, Dave, for entertaining our absurd deconstruction.
No, I love it. Yeah, thank you guys for having me, and thanks for listening in this way, like as closely as you are. It was really fun to talk.
Right.
Thanks,
on.
Man. Switched on Pop is produced by me, Charlie Harding.
And me, Nate Sloan.
Our engineering and editing is done by Bill Lance. Our community manager is Sarah Terry. And design by Luke Harris. I want to give a special thanks to Dave Longstreth for his interview. I also want to thank Jossie Adams and Zach Torino Miller, Gabe Appel, and Cameron Plummer for their insights into the Dirty Projectors.
You can find more episodes of our show at www.switchonpop.com or go to Radio Public, the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, basically anywhere you'd like to get your podcasts. There you shall find us.
You can contact us if you've got musical questions, insights, quandaries,
conundrums,
any kind of problem, really. We're here for you. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SwitchedOnPop.
We'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, thanks for listening.